Music from Mercy Me. They're looking forward to the time when they're finally home. 12 minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don Clark, a biochemist and on the board of directors at Creation Moments, and joins us every Friday. We talk about faith and creation, and we talk about things scientific, and sometimes we think about old, terrible animals here. We're going to talk about one today. Don, welcome. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Jim. I would like to say good morning to Dave, but he's probably on the road.
He's on the road, headed down to St. Cloud today. He's got some business down that way, so he's not with us at all during the morning show. And I miss the guy. There's no one to pick on here at all with David gone. So anyway, he'll be back tomorrow, and things will be kind of back to normal. We'll see. Speaking of normal, it must have been terror. Must have been a normal everyday occurrence back in Carolina in the old days. And by the old days, I mean like 230 million years ago. I think Don might dispute that number, but that's what it says in the article. This is an article posted by Reuters a couple of days ago. Will Dunham wrote the article, and he's talking about something called Carnifex carolinensis. That's one of those fancy scientific names. It translates as Carolina butcher, which sounds like it makes a good news story. But Don, what is this thing I'm looking at here?
that's a good question, especially since the artist has certainly taken some license, I would say, based on what they actually found. They actually found a part of a skull, not even a complete skull, and then also maybe some upper body bones, and then from that they get a whole picture of an animal.
Yeah, I've got a whole 3D representation here because it's a computer critter, and I'll give you the description here, and the opening of the article says the Carolina butcher has been found and is just as scary as the name suggests. Scientists, this is last Thursday now, said they had unearthed fossils in North Carolina of a big land-dwelling croc, meaning crocodile, although this may be a croc of another style here, that lived about 231 million years ago, walked on its hind legs, was a top land predator right before the first dinosaurs appeared. Could that be true? I mean, aside from the 231 million years ago, we would dispute that, but how does this animal relate to dinosaurs?
Well, he was obviously around when the dinosaurs were around, and either that or he was around after the dinosaurs were around. But of course, we know from the Bible that everything was created within the first 6 days of creation. So all of these animals that they find in different layers of rock or in sediment are obviously the result of the flood and not dying out millions and millions of years ago. So it's interesting how these folks can find these pieces of bones and then try to piece them together and try to put them into their nice geological column, when we should be looking at it and saying, okay, well, this is just another animal that existed, and probably was around a little while, and maybe even has changed into the crocodile that we know today.
Well, let me just describe it. This is the description that they draw from finding these few pieces of a skull and some front limbs, transported back to the Triassic period. What would a person experience upon encountering this agile, roughly 9 foot long, 5 foot tall beast with a long skull and blade-like teeth? Now, how do they extrapolate 9 feet long out of a skull alone, unless they've already assumed it was a crocodile? So its body shape would be longer than tall, for example.
Right. Yeah. that's a very good question, because what they found was certainly only pieces. The drawing actually looks quite similar to a... almost a complete dinosaur that they have up in Manitoba, in just north of North Dakota, in a museum up there called Bruce. And he's, you know, he's fairly tall, and they've got him kind of standing up like the picture here. And he was a mesosaur, definitely classified as a mesosaur. And this, what the picture that they've got looks like a mesosaur to me. But yet they're saying, you know, it's obviously related in the crocodile family, and maybe they're all related, you know, together in just variations within the kind, the kind of the crocodile kind, as we would call it today.
We'll show this picture of it in the podcast. You'll be able to link to this article and see the picture. But it's got kind of a crocodile head. It's got like the front arms of a Tyrannosaurus rex, but the back legs are much longer than the front legs. So that, I guess, now they don't have back legs to go by, though, do they? I mean, why did they decide it had longer back legs and walked upright? What led them to that conclusion?
Well, they don't have it. No, they have to be comparing it to other animals that they have more, at least I hope they are, more complete, you know, limbs, rather than just the upper forelimb. As they found here, they've got the, you know, maybe the spine. They said the spine and the upper forelimb of this creature, and from that they can tell how long the back legs are in relationship to the front legs. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is probably acting more like a crocodile and not standing upright. Of course, they want you to think that this animal, you know, walked on land in an upright position. And, you know, in fact, you know, crocodiles, for example, yes, well, they can walk on land, but they walk on all fours, obviously. And in the water, their back feet are typically, of course, they're in shallow waters for the most part. Their back feet are typically kind of walking along the bottom of the pond or whatever they're in, and their upper limbs are kind of floating with the upper part of their body. So more than actually walking up like that, if you could imagine them actually being in water and with their head kind of sticking out of the water, ready to pounce on something. That's kind of what reminds me of this particular creature, that, it probably just acted just exactly like a crocodile and was looking for, you know, animals either along the side of the bank or ducks or something that, you know, would land in, you know, in a body of water. And would be going after those type of things.
Well, they did find the critter's spine and portions of the skull and forelimbs. And then they said they created a three-dimensional model of the skull, filling in the missing parts with the more complete skulls of close relatives. Now, I'm thinking about the motivation here to complete the story for these scientists. I mean, is that in order to make something significant or interesting out of this? I mean, it seems like this is maybe 20% fact because they have these relics of the critter, and the rest is really vivid imagination.
Well, it is, and they're putting it in, obviously, putting it in the time frame that similar types of creatures that have been found have been put into, and into the layer of sediment that this creature was found. And so that's how they it seems that's exactly how they dated this particular one, because of the period in the geological column it was found. But that doesn't give you, I mean, that, you know, obviously a lot of scientists, a lot of paleontologists and folks have been doing this type of thing, you know, for a long, long time now, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't make it correct, especially if you have a different model than the evolutionary model. If you're, of course, thinking that, well, all of these creatures, everything on Earth, you know, evolved, and if there's any animals or creatures out in our solar system or in our, you know, vast universe, then, of course, everything evolved. as opposed to everything being created, as I said earlier, within the first 6 days, and the animals, obviously, within the day six. Mm-hmm. So in a very limited period of time.
Now explain to me why this thing would not have been, assuming it is what they picture here, why would it not be classified as a dinosaur? What's the difference between, say, a crocodile and a dinosaur? Were dinosaurs mammals and not reptiles, or how does that work?
Well, yes, they think that dinosaurs, of course, there's all different types of dinosaurs, and we normally think of T-Rex as the most famous dinosaur because we've given it a bad reputation of going around and eating people in the Jurassic Park, for example, mm-hmm. Movies like that. But dinosaur, the name is terrible lizard. So usually it implies a very large creature, and it usually implies some type of reptile. And so this is clearly some type of reptile. And so, it falls into the dinosaur category, and it's got some teeth. And so it's pretty terrible. If you would have faced this creature, 9.5 feet or 9 feet plus long, if you were to face it in a swamp or something, you'd probably run from it. You wouldn't necessarily go up to it and spend any time with it, because it looked like it could very easily eat you.
You would want to pet it on the nose, or something like that. Yeah, I wouldn't. And even the babies of this thing would not be cute.
It doesn't. It doesn't look like it's a very pettable animal.
No.
But a lot of dinosaurs were reptiles, and it's kind of all classed and put together in the same form. But even dinosaurs being created on the sixth day, for example, they're just creatures, different types of creatures that God created. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, none of these creatures ate, they were all vegetarian and didn't eat other animals, for example. That only came after the flood. And even, even for Noah and his family, even after the fall, we were still vegetarians. But after the flood, God allowed man to eat meat, because now the earth was not as beneficial, let's say, or had a positive effect on growth. It actually, things were harder to grow.
It was not as easy to subsist then on the earth after the flood.
It wasn't as easy to subsist, and then you didn't have as much protein, and so we wound up, eating lamb and goats and things, animals like that, which God allowed. But the same thing for, creatures like this. They, started eating other animals. Of course, we know the lions and the tigers, mm-hmm. The big cats, and the cats in general, eat other animals, and as well as dogs. And so, but that happened post-flood. This creature, along with the dinosaurs and many other animals that we find in quote, the fossil record, all had to be buried quickly. If you have any remains left, usually a lot of these animals are all piled up in certain areas, because after all, they got buried in a catastrophe. They got buried,
We touched on that a few weeks ago, and it had to do with, and if we just focus on North America for a minute, we find huge accumulations of dinosaur bones in Montana and then north in Canada, fewer of them south. And you had an explanation for that, didn't you? It had to do with the flood and how it traversed the land here in North America.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the coastal zones had much greater sediment than the further you go, inward, at least in the continent of Americas. which is easily explained if you've got tsunamis, you know, crashing into both coasts, especially the eastern coast of America, then you would expect to find not only in the sediments, but you would expect to find more animals in certain areas. As of course, immediately after the flood, the ice age began, and things began to freeze over. But there were pockets even inland that remained relatively warm because of inland currents, air currents, for example, that would take the warm air from the oceans and bring them inward. And so you had these pockets of areas where a large number of animals could still live, even during the ice age. And of course we find the mastodons and other types of creatures that don't get buried until the latter part of the ice age, when the oceans started to cool down, and then we had tremendous dust storms, for example, that buried those types of animals very, very quickly. And of course, you know, today we find whole mastodons. That's a different thing than what we're finding here. These are just pieces of animals, because they were caught up at some point in time in this tremendous upheaval after the flood, after the tsunamis and great walls of water were hitting the continents, and the continents were moving apart, and we had all kinds of upheaval post-flood we didn't have pre-flood, for example, because the continents weren't breaking apart.
How fast do you think all that happened? There's the flood, there's earthquakes, there's the volcanic activity. The world is really getting shaken up here, and we have this huge single continent called Pangaea that then starts to break up, whether it's along fault lines or, you know, how the borders came to be, I'm not sure. But at some point, the continents started to drift apart. How long after the initial flood do you suppose that happened? Because I'm wondering about East Coast versus West Coast. You know, the landmass might have had what we would think of as a West Coast then, but not an East Coast, because there was this huge expanse of land headed eastward yet for us. I mean, the Eastern Seaboard would not have been flooded. It would have been actually inland on a single continent.
Right, yeah, initially, of course, as the continents started drifting apart, and we started to drift apart from Africa and from Europe, for example, then there would be tremendous earthquakes happening, especially subterranean earthquake. Earthquakes under the ocean that was rapidly being filled in as the continents moved apart. But as far as the time frame, we're looking probably about, it lasted probably between 500 to 700 years after the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the earth probably started breaking up the week before the flood, because we have at least some evidence in a book called the Book of Yarish, for example, that is quite interesting read. It kind of parallels the first part of, it has Noah, it has his family, his ancestors are recorded in it, and it describes the week prior to the flood and what was happening. There was a lot of shaking and movement of the earth.
So this is another ancient document then.
It's an ancient book. Yeah, you can you can Google it, and you know, you can actually pick up a copy, a free copy, you know, online. It's extra biblical, but it was certainly written by obviously Jews. The ancient folks, or Hebrews, not, there weren't Jews back then, but you know. It was written by a fellow by the name of Yarish. So he chronicled the events. We have a little more detail than what we have, obviously, in the Bible. and kind of fills in some pieces as to, for example, where did Noah get his wife and whose daughter was she? And it turns out that, you know, she was, came from the line of Enoch. And so, you know, she was a relative, obviously, of Noah. But it gave you the idea that she was a righteous woman. So you had a righteous man and a righteous woman. And hopefully their offspring were going to be more righteous than the rest of the people around them. But in addition to giving you the idea that God is really gracious and he would, you know, wishes none should perish, and so the people around Noah, when all of this was going on, I mean, Noah was still preaching, for example, come on to the ark, you know, folks, there's plenty of room, just come on, you know, there's a flood that's coming, and they continued to obviously laugh and mock him, even when these earthquakes were going on, which they had never felt before, and did not come onto the ark. And so they obviously suffered the wrath of God at that point in time, because he gave them every opportunity. He gave them almost over 100 years of preaching, by Methuselah and by Noah, for example, and, you know, opportunities to come help. Let's not perish. This thing is coming. Repent, and they did not. Mm-hmm. Kind of giving you the picture of what's going to happen in the end times as well. But anyway, you had all of this activity going on. So there was geological. My point is that there was geological activity even before the flood, started. So kind of suggesting that, well, maybe the continent started to break up, before the flood, and obviously continued. The continents drifting apart with continuous volcanic activity, obviously coming in spurts, which would have provided the kind of a cloud canopy that was necessary to sustain a long period of cold, mm-hmm. cold weather, which we obviously called the Ice Age.
Now, at that point, is it safe to assume that most human beings, the human population, was pretty well centered in what we now call the Middle East, that is the Eastern Mediterranean and across what is now Iran and Iraq? And because before that, back in the garden, Cain left east with his people, and I'm thinking maybe Afghanistan into China. So Asia may have had some population, but probably west of what is now Israel, there were a few people. And therefore no reports, no eyewitness accounts of all this activity. Would that be accurate?
Well, we don't really have a good record as to where all the people were, but you would have thought that most of them were centered around the Middle East, what we call the Middle East today.
That's where the oldest literature comes from, though, isn't it? The oldest signs of buildings and cities and an alphabet and writing. That's pretty well centered in the Fertile Crescent, is it not?
Yes, it is. And so you know, with what we now call the Mediterranean, you know, it was probably a sea of some sort, even before the flood, obviously. There probably was a pretty large population in that area as well. I mean, it doesn't take long for people to migrate, but part of the problem with man is he likes to dwell together, even when God had given the commandments to disperse and multiply and fill the earth. That that commandment was even given to basically to Noah after that commandment didn't stop because we had the flood. And now people had to dwell together. Well, you know, as the numbers increase, you know, God still expected folks to disperse. And obviously we have the Tower of Babel, and we've talked about in a different program about about that and how God had to disperse the people because they weren't dispersing. They were coming together and trying to build a name for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you look from a spiritual point of view, what's the purpose? Why did God, you know, break up this supercontinent called Pangaea? I mean, why did he, you know, even, you know, have to do that? Well, you know, if people are evil, the best way to keep them living the longest is to have isolated pockets of folks. And so what better way than, okay, we got this big continent, let's break it up into smaller pieces, and then, you know, disperse the people throughout these various continents, and that way they can have a, in quote, a peaceful life. If something goes wrong with a people group, you know, over here in one pocket, it's not affecting so much a people group in another area. So huge mountain ranges are formed even on the continents, even on the continents that we do have. And that becomes a barrier for people, you know, to migrate from one place to another. So people get isolated, and after the Tower of Babel, they have their own language now. And so they're being dispersed throughout various areas. But the mountain ranges were still forming as people are migrating. So they could have easily, you know, gotten around the lower mountains at the mm-hmm. time. And to populate these various areas. So, yeah, it's an interesting question.
Interesting theory from Jared Diamond, too. He had a book a few years ago, quite a book, and I've read it. It's called Guns, Germs, and Steel. And he writes about his theories of how ancient civilizations survived, which ones did survive and which ones didn't. And he maintains that where there was the east or westward movement of a people group, they tended to survive because they could oftentimes carry seeds, eat the same kind of foods because they remained at the same latitude. Whereas if they were restricted to north-south travel, they tended to perish because wherever they moved resulted in sometimes severe climate changes. So I'm trying to see the pattern of mountains and pathways here, how much east-west movement versus north-south. And I think he may have had something there. What do you think?
Well, yeah, that certainly makes sense. Obviously, we know that people did move north because we have the Japhites, if you will, the sons of Japheth, did tend to migrate northward into Europe, into northern parts of Europe, into Russia, what we now call Russia, mm-hmm. and over to the northern parts, eventually over to the northern parts of Asia. Whereas you had the eastern movement and the southeastern movement that went along, you know, the coastline, which were
around the Mediterranean, and they went across North Africa, that is toward the west, and on the north side they bent around toward Turkey and Greece and Rome. Some of the early civilizations were built, and of course Egypt right in the middle of it all. That kind of explains the. I think the maturity of those cultures before anybody else reached that stage. I mean, that was the starting point. So, and it's an interesting and convoluted discussion this morning for sure. And it all started with this thing that they call the Carolina Butcher. We'll post our podcast with Don on the website in an hour or two, so you'll be able to read this article if you're so inclined. It's Reuters. You could actually go to the Reuters news service and just probably search under Carolina Butcher, and you'll see a picture of this very imaginative critter that was built out of a spine and a couple of forelimbs and parts of a skull, and yeah, he would be a pretty fearsome creature if you ran into him in the dark or even in full sunshine. I think you would tend to go the other way. Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments, I'd like to recommend their website. I'd like to recommend Creation Moments as a resource for you. What they're about is presenting the science behind a young Earth creationist point of view. And it's not emotional, it's not confrontational, it's pretty well factual. Wouldn't you say, Don? I think that's what distinguishes Creation Moments from some of the other young Earth websites and movements, is it the rationality behind it all. This is science, isn't it?
Well, it is. There is obviously science, and looking back, you can look back in it from a point of view of, well, an evolutionary point of view. But if you take the creation point of view and you look to see what the Bible has to say about it, you know, things fall into place quite nicely as to what we actually find. And that's what we try to present on our Creation Moments website.
The pieces come together nicely there. It's creationmoments.com. You'll find them a wonderful resource for your church. They publish bulletins, and they have books, and they have DVDs, marvelous resources for your church and Bible studies and small group discussions and the like. Dr. Dodds in Garden Valley, Texas, we thank you for joining us today. Look forward to, let's see, next week. Yeah, next week should be okay. You're available next Tuesday?
Well, it should be, yes.
Okay. Well, I think we'll find some other, probably stay away from weird creatures for next week. And we'll head to some other area of discussion here. Don, have a great day. We'll see you in a week.
Okay, very good. You too.
Bye-bye.
So long.